Welcome to the Resilient Recruiter Podcast. I'm your host, Mark Whitby, and we're joined today by Mary Morton.
I can't make somebody take a job. I need to focus more on, am I introducing them to the right job? Am I introducing the candidate that is most suited for the job and pleasing my clients? I don't know. I just stopped thinking about the money and started being more focused on doing a good job and pleasing the people I'm serving.
Mary began her recruiting career almost 30 years ago, and for the last 25 years, she specialized in the pharmaceutical industry.
I do have a bachelor's degree in biology and took a number of pharmacology classes. And as far as how I educate myself, I can read New England Journal articles along with some sort of medical lexicon and figure out what all these things mean. But I think one of the other things I do quite a bit of is staying on top of a lot of the things going on in the investment community.
She owns Sembio, which is a niche recruiting firm specialized in medical affairs, and she founded it in 2008 with her longtime colleague and business partner, Nicole Evans. Mary's been a member of the Pinnacle Society for 7 years. She has a 360-degree desk and focuses on account management.
If we took a position, we were dedicated to filling it. And we were also okay with saying, I'm not going to be your best person to take that job, which is hard. When you're struggling, I hate to say it, but we were, to tell a company, I can't take that biostatistician job. There's zero chance I'm going to fill that. But then they respect the fact that you tell them.
Over the past 15 years, Mary has personally billed over $10 million. And she also has her own podcast, which is MSL Lead Chronicles. Mary, welcome. Thank you so much for doing this.
Thanks, Mark. Thanks for having me.
So last time I saw you was here in Edinburgh when you and your family were traveling around the UK and Ireland, which was so much fun. I think that was not last summer, but the summer before, right? So it was about 18 months ago coming up for. How was that experience?
That was really awesome. And we were very fortunate enough to be in Edinburgh at just the right time because the Fringe Festival was going on. And that was, I guess, very similar to like South by Southwest, which we have here in Austin in the springtime. And then there was, I can't remember, you're going to have to remind me, the more like military theme.
Oh, the tattoo?
The tattoo, right.
Yeah.
I've tried to tell somebody that story for like the past 2 weeks, and I can't remember what it's called. So thank you. Yes, the tattoo. And that was really neat too.
Oh, cool. You got to see that. What was the what was the highlight?
Of Edinburgh?
Of your trip, yeah.
Well, we went to my daughter and I stayed a few weeks after my husband and my son came back because my son had to start high school. So it's hard to say. There was so much history to see. But the end of our trip was actually at the Reading Music Festival.
Oh, cool.
And that was pretty awesome. So I'm a big music fan. But gosh, I don't know. Yeah, the Edinburgh Castle was amazing and surreal. Especially walking down that main street where it's like shop, 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 giant old castle on the other side of the street. But it was a beautiful city and the entire trip was just amazing.
Oh, it sounds like a really special thing to do all together with your family. Yeah, I'm kind of just used to it, so I don't really notice it anymore. But I remember when I very first moved here in 1997, coming to work and, you know, just being blown away by, you had the castle and the Royal Mile you're describing and Calton Hill, and it's all these old buildings and stuff. It was pretty cool. Where I used to live when my kids were growing up, we actually lived near a castle called Craig Miller Castle. And so we would just go there. Like, it was a 5-minute drive from my house. So we would just go and play hide and seek in this castle, which was pretty cool. And the kids would like dress up and they'd bring their swords and they'd do sword fighting in the courtyard and stuff. And so, yeah. That was pretty awesome. So since we last really caught up, you've launched a podcast, which is awesome. And I'm looking forward to hearing about that. I missed you at the last Pinnacle Society conference, by the way.
I know.
A couple of weeks ago.
Well, my husband surprised me with tickets to the U.S. Grand Prix F1 race that's here in Austin, and I love F1, and my favorite driver, Carlos Sainz, won, which was incredible. I think it's his first race he won this year, maybe his second, but I had to pass for that.
Well, that's pretty cool. I've never been to a Formula One race, so.
Yeah, it's loud.
Awesome.
But it's cool.
Yeah, I bet. So, Mary, how did you first get into recruitment, by the way?
I feel like it's probably a very familiar story to most people, at least who have been recruiting around as long as I have. It was an accident. One of my very best friends went in to be interviewed by a recruiter for a job, and they talked her into being a recruiter for them. And then she called me. She goes, "Oh my gosh, this is the job for you." I'm like, "I don't even know what that is. I don't even know what a headhunter is."
Exactly.
It feels like something I heard about on Melrose Place or something. But you know, I think when you know, you know. And in the first 4 days on the job, I was like, "This is it." I just loved everything about it. And one of my my trainers, his name was Clark Farner. I'll never forget. Clark would always laugh at me because I would go, "I love my job," and because I would say it like multiple times a day. So yeah, that's just fell into it by accident,
awesome.
Like most people.
So tell me, Mary, what was it in you that your friend, when she started working as a recruiter, she knew this was the job for you?
Well, it's probably my personality and my drive, but also that I have this desire to know everything there is to know about anything that I'm interested in. And, you know, to be a good recruiter, you really have to be a good one. You have to be sort of a nerd of whatever it is in the space that you're working in.
Yes, and so, absolutely. Yeah.
And I'm just very much a people person, so.
Sure. But I mean, there's other people jobs that aren't as hard as this, right? So I don't think being a people person is enough. It's kind of it's definitely a prerequisite, but I don't know, you know, there's lots of things you could do with people, but I think it's combined with the drive that you mentioned. Where does the drive come from?
My father. So, and maybe that's one of the reasons I thought the tattoo was really cool. So my dad was a Marine. And so he was in the Marine Corps for 31 years, which I don't know how it is now, but you're not allowed to be in the Marine Corps for 31 years. You 30 years and you're out. And so he had to have a special approval from the commandant of the Marine Corps to have an extra year because he wanted to be over 30 years. But my father, very driven, very motivated. I think all of my positive attributes around being on time and keeping your word and if you're late, soldiers die. I mean, that's not my world, but that was his. But that's the seriousness of being accountable and responsible and not stopping till you're done and your mission is accomplished.
I love that. That is awesome. So 30 years in recruiting and the last 15 years alone, you've built over $10 million. What are the critical success factors that have enabled you to do that, Mary?
You know, I feel like recruiters, they start out their careers being very motivated on the end, which is the placement, the money. And even though, like one of my mentors, Barbara Bruno, used to always say, you know, you've got to focus on the send out. It took me a number of years to really get that ingrained in my head. And I think at one point when I let all of that minutia go and started realizing or more focusing on the fact that these are people. And it changed my outlook. And it's not just the people whose careers I'm holding and I'm trying to place them in a job, but it's the people who are hiring them. It's the people I'm dealing with every day. And then I started thinking about my dad. And for him, like, reputation is paramount. And having people trust and respect you and know that they can count on you, also paramount. And so I think just realizing that I can't make somebody take a job. I need to focus more on, am I introducing them to the right job? Am I introducing the candidate that is most suited for the job and pleasing my clients? I don't know. I just stopped thinking about the money and started being more focused on doing a good job and pleasing the people I'm serving. I think candidates are really shocked when I talk to them. And
really? Why?
When I say things like, if this job isn't for you, you're not going to hurt my feelings. I'm not going to try to, you know, cram a square peg into a round hole. I want you to want to talk to me again in the future. I don't want you to hate my guts because you felt like you were misled or I withheld information from you. I mean, I talk to so many candidates who are, if it's the first time I'm talking to them, they are a little bit suspicious sometimes or apprehensive because maybe the recruiters that they've spoken to before, that is how they are. I had a candidate one time tell me that when she turned down a position that he had represented her to, that he like lost his mind because he said, how could you do this to me? Which I thought was crazy. Don't you know my wife is pregnant? How could you do this to me? And I think when I heard that story, I was like, how could you do that to her? How could you say that to her? This isn't even about you. This is about her career. I don't know. It just kind of changed the way I looked at things. I know it's a really long way to answer your question, but I think when I stopped worrying about those little things and started thinking about the big picture and knew what I was doing was coming from my heart, I think it changed everything.
So that perspective, that sort of overall philosophy in terms of the way that you do business, the way you see recruiting, and money is a byproduct of doing things right and focusing on the things you mentioned. So pleasing your client, putting people into the right opportunities, being transparent and authentic with, your communication. So I love that. What caused that sort of shift where it kind of crystallized and you thought, oh, this is actually how I'm going to relate to my clients and candidates from now on?
I don't really know that there was like a singular event. I think, and in all aspects of life, you get positive reinforcement that makes you want to keep repeating a behavior. And so when you hear someone say to you, I really value the way that you treated me through this process, you want to keep repeating that. And I feel like it just sort of slowly evolved. The first recruiting firm that I worked at, the one that my friend had gotten me into, I worked there for 10 years. And they are no longer in business. They were called Magic. And it was a national firm. And They were very much the opposite. Like I had a district manager who one time, and we would bring the candidates into the office. One time I had brought in a young guy who had just graduated from college. He had an offer for him and it was like heavy industry, manufacturing, something like that. And he put his finger in his face to close him. He's like, because the guy says, I want to talk to my parents about this. And he goes, he talked to him in such a demeaning way and put his finger in his face and said, oh, you got to go home and talk to mommy and see if she'll let you take this job. You know, it's time for you to be a man.
Oh, my gosh.
It was like, I could never do that. But the philosophy there was, it was about money. It wasn't about the people as much. And it just kind of made me feel gross. That company ultimately is now out of business. They fell on some financial hard times after 9/11. And the only group making any money was my group. We were in the pharmaceutical industry. And pharmaceutical industry's somewhat like Teflon. You know, people are always going to be sick, unfortunately. And the company actually started when they would withhold our payroll taxes, they wouldn't send them to the IRS.
Oh, that's bad.
Instead, they used those to pay utilities or whatever other bills or people's salaries. And they did the same thing with our 401k deductions. These are like major federal violations. So I took myself and most of my team and went to another company. We stayed there for about 3 years. And then after that is when Nicole and I left and started Symbio. And it was somewhere in between there when I had really made that shift where, and I think that's one of the reasons that we wanted to start our own company is because we had our own moral compass. Nicole and I, and the way we wanted to do things and the way we wanted to treat people that worked for us, you know, besides our candidates and our clients. And it really allowed us to follow our own moral compass.
Absolutely. That all makes a lot of sense. So I love this, by the way, Mary. So in addition to operating in a way that it is in alignment with what you believe and what you stand for and your morals and your ethical framework, what are some other factors that you, because I think that's a phenomenal foundation, but I don't know that that by itself is enough to have achieved the level of success you have. So what are some of the other ingredients?
Yeah, I think you're actually exactly right. I mean, that was the foundation of it. So what are the ingredients? I mean, I think it's we walk the talk. You know, a lot of recruiters say that they are relationship based. But we actually walk that. So everything that we do is about continuing those relationships to really bring value to our clients. Again, I've already said I'm a big music fan. I'm also a Deadhead. And
okay, cool.
So the Grateful Dead has a philosophy of giving things away. You know, I think they were the first band that allowed people to record their concerts for free, where other people call that bootlegging, you know, and then they would they basically gave that away. That's a philosophy I share as well. I will give candidates to a potential client, or to an existing client who says they just don't have budget for this one particular position. I'll make that introduction for free because it's about the long term and it's about building trust. And I think it would be a horrible thing to do to stand between a candidate and a company and a position because in this particular time, they can't pay a fee.
Can you give an example of that? Because this is very unusual in our business. Can you tell me about a time when that you made that decision, why you did, and then what the repercussions of that were?
Well, I just did it yesterday. For a longtime hiring manager of mine who is in between jobs right now, and a company that I'm working with right now that I have two MSL positions I'm working on, and this position is for an MSL director role. Repercussions, I don't know yet because I just made that introduction yesterday, but there is another big pharma company that I introduced a national MSL director for their dermatology team for free, and now they're my client. So that's a very positive repercussion there. And also, that director has now moved on to another company. And when she did that, when they needed to hire MSLs, she called me. And I placed three MSLs with her this year. I'm showing and establishing that I'm not just in it for the dollar. I don't have to have the dollar every single time. And I have such a huge network. Losing one placement fee in the grand scheme of things is nothing when you're building like this really long-term relationship that's going to come back and pay you tenfold or more, probably.
This is so interesting, Mary. So can you give me a bit more context of how this would come about? Like, how would you arrive at the decision of, oh, well, this person's really interested in your company. I understand you don't have the budget to pay a placement fee, so why don't you just hire them anyway? Like, what leads into that, you know, that scenario unfolding?
Well, this particular one that occurred 3 years ago. And I was doing a business development call because, and this is probably another thing we can talk about, like, because I am a huge, huge science nerd. I know and read and research things to like the molecular level, the scientific level about how drugs work and things like that. And okay. So this one particular hiring manager who's working in dermatology, we were talking about this particular product that was in clinical development, the MOA, the mechanism of action, how it works. And I said, they're building a team where they're going to hire a bunch of MSLs, and that would be great for you. And she goes, oh, do you know anybody there? And I said, I do. I know the VP of Medical Affairs. I'll call her. And so I called her. And she told me the name of the recruiter, the in-house recruiter, and to give her a call. And it was towards the end of the year. And so I called her and she said, your candidate sounds great. And I know you talked to the VP and everything, but this, you know, this is when you got a big company. We aren't renewing our vendors list until January. It seems like red tape, but for whatever reason, it does take forever. But, and I was like, well, what do I do here? Do I really stand in the way where I've just gotten this hiring manager of mine really excited about this opportunity? So I call her back and say, hey, you know, that thing we were talking about, it's off the table now because they can't work with me for at least 3 months. That would be inhumane. I don't know how anybody could do that to somebody. And then she's just going to apply. And maybe they'll find her in the database when she applies. Maybe they won't. Maybe they'll miss her. You know, I think the number was 97% of people who apply for a position are not qualified for it. So if 200 people apply for a job, you got to hope that they don't miss her in the 200 that they're passing over. So
what did you say? Like, yeah. So what did you physically do? Like you said, hey, listen, what was the conversation?
With the talent acquisition person, I said, okay. So when is the vendor's list renewal thing going to be? And she said, January. And I said, well, That's like 3 months away. What I would like to do is make this introduction for free. Because I think she's exactly what you guys need. And I think she'd be very excited about the opportunity. But in January, when it's time to do the vendors list, I would really appreciate to have another conversation with you. And she's like, absolutely. Absolutely. I've never had a recruiter offer to give me a candidate before. And I still feel like she was probably a little skeptical about whether or not this candidate was going to be what I said she was. And she was. And they hired her, national director. And that's how the conversation went down. And then...
Wow. Okay. Interesting. So let me play devil's advocate for a second, Mary. Aren't you concerned in that scenario that the company is just going to take advantage of you and not honor like their side of things and just try and really... You know, because like you're talking about like multi-billion-dollar corporations, or maybe they're a startup, but they've got funding in the, you know, millions. And so this kind of money seems like it's small for them, but it's big for a small business like ours. Do you not feel like they might take advantage of your, you know, your ethics and your generosity?
Well, If they were to do that, then I would not want to work with them anyway.
That's a good point.
I have to say that has happened.
Okay. Yeah.
But not a lot. But I don't give a lot of candidates away. I a fair share I do.
Yeah. All right. Awesome. So this is one great example of your philosophy of relationship-based recruiting. And what other ways, and I love how detailed that example was. The reason is everyone says they believe in building relationships, right? It's kind of a cliche, but what does that really mean? And how does that translate into the day-to-day conversations and business decisions you're making? You know, so in addition to giving away, by the way, I want to circle back to the business development and the science nerd conversation because I'm interested in both of those. But are there any other ways in which you can elaborate on the idea of relationship-based recruiting?
Whenever I'm working on a position for a client, I pretty much, if it's the first time I'm working with them, I'm letting them know from the jump that this is how we're going to do this. I'm going to gather a bunch of information from you. We're going to have a long conversation up front that you're probably going to think is unnecessary because other recruiters you've worked with, you probably just said, here's the job description, go find me some people, but I'm not going to do it that way. I need to know not just the tangibles, but the intangibles, skill gaps, that you want to use this opportunity to try to fill. And I want to try to bring the most value to you that I can. And also, I'm going to tell you things you probably aren't going to be happy to hear. Because once my team starts recruiting on these positions and people say I'm not interested, we're going to find out why. And sometimes it's negative impression on the street. Sometimes it's going to be because they don't like your drugs. Or they don't like your leadership. And I'm going to tell you those things because I'm going to need you to tell me how I should rebut, how I should respond. Or you might say, well, that's absolutely true. Then at least we're prepared for it. And I do that. Once we get to the science nerd thing, we can talk about that a little bit more. But I feel like my job is to bring value to them. And sometimes it's value not in the form of a warm body in a chair. Sometimes it's market information, competitor information. You know, my group knows so much about like almost literally every pharmaceutical and biotech company out there and about what's going on with them, that sometimes I talk to an MSL and I'm surprised that, oh, you don't know about this company? Well, I mean, all they do is live and breathe the company they're at. So we have to have all that information so that we can bring value to those people.
Love it. This is great, Mary. I'm really enjoying learning how your mind works and how you do business. So
it's a scary place in there.
Well, okay. Well, let's talk about Science Nerd. Did you have a science degree, or how did you come to, like, what? Why did you gravitate to pharmaceuticals, and how do you educate yourself on all the drugs and everything that's like the what your clients' products actually do?
I do have a bachelor's degree in biology, and took a number of pharmacology classes, and it's just I'm just that. That's how my brain works. As far as how I educate myself, I can read New England Journal articles along with some sort of medical lexicon and figure out what all these things mean. But I think one of the other things I do quite a bit of is staying on top of a lot of the things going on in the investment community. I attend virtually because a lot of them are video, but the investor, like the JP Morgan, Cantor Fitzgerald, and I watch their investor presentations where I can hear from them their enthusiasm and also learn about what they have in development in the pipeline and why it matters. So that's actually quite a lot of what I do in terms of business development is attending a lot of these because it tells me what I'm going to be interested in recruiting on. I like to work a lot in like rare diseases and what they call them unmet needs. I mean, either there's not there's nothing to treat a particular disease or there's not very much. I feel like it really makes a difference for patients. And myself and my group, we get involved in a lot of organizations that help serve these communities too, like Cure Duchenne, which supports Duchenne muscular dystrophy, or the Tuberous Sclerosis Society. Actually later today, I'm heading to a conference. It's here in Austin. Actually, it's the Hidradenitis Suppurativa Foundation, which is a dermatologic condition. I attend conferences, I read articles, and I like to attend a lot of these companies' individual investor presentations.
This is awesome. Really, I love how you immerse yourself in the whole ecosystem that you serve, the investors as well as the pharmaceutical companies. And so how do you, this is a very strategic approach to business development. You're not just seeing who has openings and chasing those. You're actually starting from the, like, which companies are JP Morgan investing in and why is it important? How do you go from there to actually turning that into a client?
That's a good question. Well, once I discover a little bit about the company, I start researching if they have a medical affairs function in place yet. And if they don't, like if most of the time they'll start with like a VP of medical affairs. And since all the people that we place are field-based, these medical liaisons, I don't know how much you know about them, but they work a lot in it's not sales, so they don't sell, but they liaise between physicians and their own companies to help sort of drive strategy and how they can reach the community. And so these MSLs, these medical liaisons, they're all field-based. So they may have a team of like 10 or 20, and then they have like a territory. So the first thing that they will need to hire is like a VP of medical affairs who's going to kind of design how all this is going to roll out. If they don't have a VP of medical affairs, I'm reaching out to the CMO and I'm saying, okay, you guys are in phase two. It's time to start building out your medical affairs infrastructure. And, you know, I guess since I've been working in this space for as long as I have, it's not unusual for me to already know a CMO and just call them up and say, hey, Jim, I've been watching your pipeline and it looks like it's about time. What are we waiting for? Or if there is a VP of medical affairs that is already in place, I'm probably having a conversation with them about what is their plan? When do they foresee building out a field-facing group? I guess it's because at this point, like I have a network. I just call people that I know that may be with the company. Or I will call somebody who is working at a company that is a competitor or that they are trying to be a competitor and ask them what they know about the company and what do they think about their data and do they think it's viable?
Interesting. So Mary, pretend you don't know Jim and you don't have a contact with that company, but you can see that they're at a stage where they will need to build out their team of medical liaisons. How would you approach them in that instance where it's like you have no contact within that business?
Well, that's really interesting that you would ask me that question because the reason I'm going to this medical meeting this weekend is because there's a company that I've been telling my coworkers that I've been stalking. They're a European, they're a European company. They have no presence in the United States right now. And they're about at that stage where they should be thinking about building out. And the reason I even found out that this meeting was happening is because I watched their fireside chat and their chief scientific officer said, and we're going to be in Austin, Texas in the fall at the HS Foundation meeting. I'm like, well, then so am I. they are sponsoring a networking event this evening that I plan to go to. And I may put a glass of wine in myself and then walk up to them and introduce myself. I'm just kidding about that. But I plan to introduce myself. Let them know I've seen their fireside chat and let them know all the other things that I've seen of theirs and that I've read their data and I've talked to people who are currently working in the dermatology space and they are equally excited about this trispecific that they are developing and that I have connections with the people that they are going to need in the United States, especially since they don't have anyone in the United States at all right now.
This is brilliant, Mary. What if they weren't they didn't happen to be coming to Austin? What would be another way that you might approach the decision maker?
So that one's tricky because the decision maker is in Germany. I would probably email him or try to send a LinkedIn message and try to make a connection. But if it was somebody, let's just say that's in the United States and I could literally pick up the phone and call them, I would pick up the phone and call them and would ask for a request a meeting. And, I could send a mailer with my brochure or whatever, but they probably get enough solicitations like that that are less personal. And I don't know how believable that is without getting to hear it from
me. You just pick up the phone and reach out.
Yes. Very old school. Introduce myself. You don't know me, but yeah.
They have telephones in Germany, so you could call your person there as well.
That's true. I did think about that.
Yeah.
But
the executives are, you know, fluent in English anyway.
Yeah. And they have phones, you said. You're sure about that?
I'm pretty sure.
Okay. All right, cool.
So, Mary, it's hard to get a live human being to pick up if they don't recognize your number. So let's say you send them an invite in LinkedIn. I want to get really detailed here, by the way, because I want to understand Mary's business development process. So you send them a note on LinkedIn, you call them, you don't get an answer. Where do we go from there?
Well, it doesn't happen like that very often.
Really? How not? People respond to you.
Well, I usually have some sort of, you know, 2 degrees of Kevin Bacon thing, you know, where I know somebody that knows them or, but oftentimes if I let them know I have been researching their company for months, I have attended their investor presentations. I watched your fireside chat. I am more well connected in this space as a headhunter than you'll probably ever meet. You know, I feel like I have a natural, honest, genuine style that they know I'm not BSing them.
Yeah. Okay. I think the power of this, Mary, not only do you have impressive credentials, you've been doing it a long time, you've got lots of, you know, you could give case studies and company names that you've helped build out, but you do a lot of, like, do you always do that much research before you do a business, like a business development call, or where you're attending the fireside, you're reading their, you know, research and...
Yeah, absolutely.
So in that case, it's a very targeted and very well-researched business development call. And when you're able to say, look, I've done this, I've researched that, I've seen your fireside chat, that dramatically increases the likelihood they're going to respond to that, right?
Yes, I think so. Yeah.
So here's why I'm asking, Mary. Matt, someone's listening and they need help with business development, and they want to think they, you know, what can I learn from Mary Morton that I can apply to my business? Probably not in pharmaceuticals or, you know, MSLs, but what's the transferable aspect to that? And so, I mean, number one, the takeaway is get really deep into your niche so that you know what's going on, you know who the investors are, you're attending the conferences, you're you know, attending the virtual events, you're reading the literature, you know which companies are getting funding and which ones are growing, you're actually asking, you know, for feedback in the market. What do you think of this company? And you, so there's a lot of, this is the nerd part, which is like, you're really going deep here. But then any other advice that you would give them?
Well, if they're already niched, I think they owe it to themselves as well as to the candidates and clients that they're serving to be an expert in the space that they're niched in or that they claim to be niched in. You know, I think that's where the value comes. I was just talking to my group this morning about a position that we just got in, and it was part of what we do is like, whenever I put together like a big list of information about the position, the selling points, and then there's also one that is potential objections. And since we talk to people who are scientific in nature, because our MSLs, they usually have a PhD or a PharmD or something like that, they're going to ask us questions that could be scientifically driven. And so we need to be able to discuss those things. So the objections that I said these candidates might have an objection be about the cost of this drug compared to these other drugs that are actually generic and can be used as well. They don't work as well. But, you know, if a candidate you talk to says that, this is the background information you can share. to kind of try to overcome that, then we can do a better job. So if somebody's working, I don't know any of this technical stuff, but like if somebody's working in AI technology and they can know everything there is to know about what's being developed in AI. And if they have a position and they can anticipate that a candidate they're going to call may have an objection about this company or this part of the job, and they can be prepared to overcome that because they've done their homework and they know what that marketplace looks like, then they're going to be that much more effective at the job. And this is one of the things I tell my recruiters is, it is very hard to turn a no into a yes. So if you have all of the information now, then you don't have to call them back later and try to turn their no into a yes, because you had the information from the jump.
Great. Love this. By the way, this is we have a client who recruits an AI. So this is shout out to Olga Sattler. This that Mary's talking right to you. So brilliant. Mary, you've mentioned your group a few times. Can I ask you a few quick fire questions so that people understand a bit more about your business? So you guys permanent or contract or both?
We are both, actually. We have all kinds of solutions, but primarily perm or direct.
Okay. And is it contingent or retained?
It is a little bit of both, but mostly contingent.
Okay, cool. What's an average fee size typically?
Like, probably, I would just say 50,000.
Okay, cool. And then as far as your company is concerned, what's the sort of team size and what's the structure of that? You mentioned that you run a 360 desk still, but you're also a manager. So you're a billing manager in effect. How many other team members do you have and what are the different roles?
We have eight, and I mentioned to you that my business partner that I started the company with just recently passed away. I was having trouble coming up with the number of people because I'm used to saying nine.
Mary, I'm so sorry to hear that.
So yes, Nicole, she's wonderful. So we have two account managers and we have six recruiters, and I have a social media person and a researcher.
So that's fantastic. And then tech stack, what sort of technology are you guys using?
So our CRM that we use or our applicant tracking system is PC Recruiter. We have Ring Central for our phones, and we use things like Swordfish or Signal, whatever that's called. Can't remember what it's called. Is it Signal?
I don't know. I know Swordfish finds phone numbers and email addresses.
And then LinkedIn, obviously. And we are easing our way into ChatGPT. This is like my new thing that I have just started doing is because whenever we submit a candidate, we write a write-up or a submittal for the candidate. Now that I've discovered that I can dictate it in my email, because I don't want it to read real stiff. So I have my headset on and I dictate it into my email and it just reads very naturally. So yeah, I don't know. They use more of the technology stuff than I do.
All right. Okay. No problem. Because I was going to say you could transcribe those candidate interviews and then get AI to write the write-up for you. Just a thought.
Yeah, I don't want AI to do that for me.
Okay.
I do have Hinterview.
Yep. Awesome.
Yeah.
Is there one tool that you couldn't live without?
I don't think I can live without any of them.
Okay. So they're okay. Fair enough.
But definitely the phone, because I think that's the difference. And for me is, you know, from the relationship side, you can't build a relationship over email.
No, sir.
Or text message.
Yeah, absolutely. So for you, the phone is still king then. I like it. So tell me about the podcast. Why did you just start? Why did you decide to launch a podcast?
Oh, thank you. So MSL League Chronicles is a podcast that I do along with a guy named Chad Fellers. He is currently a, I don't know what his exact title is now, but he's been a director of MSLs for many, many years. And he was a hiring manager of mine in the past. And we just, we bounce a lot of ideas off of each other. And from a leadership perspective, the way the MSL job works is very similar to how a recruiter's job works. And that's probably another conversation for another day. So from a leadership perspective, the leadership of those people ends up being very similar. So he and I used to share a lot of leadership ideas and concepts with each other. And there is an MSL podcast out there that's really geared towards individual contributors. And he said, there's a gap out there providing resources to leadership and people who want to move into leadership. And we've been talking about this for a couple of years, and it wasn't about podcasts. It was just about what kind of resources could you and I maybe partner up on to provide. And then at the end of last year, he goes, let's do a podcast. And I said, okay. And then like I ran with it. You know, I created a logo. My daughter, Paige, who you met, wrote our theme music.
Oh, and cool.
Yeah. Yeah. Really good.
She created your own theme music. I love that.
Yes, she did. She wrote it. And she wouldn't let me play the tambourine. She said, I don't have any rhythm, but but there's no tambourine on it. And so because we both have full-time jobs and we can't do this podcast thing, you know, full time, we have two podcasts a month. And sometimes we have a guest. Well, actually, most of the time we have a guest. Sometimes we don't. And then we try to put some additional material out during the week that may be just like 3-minute piece here and there. But it's all intended to help support people in leadership tackle leadership problems.
That is awesome. I'm so proud of you that you've dived into that. And so that makes sense why it's MSL Lead, right? Because you're focused on the leadership. And so how many episodes have you done so far?
So we're actually recording episode number 23 this afternoon.
All right. Congratulations, Mary. That's fantastic.
Yes.
And what sort of feedback are you getting so far?
A lot of positive feedback, because they're like, thank you so much for putting this together. This has definitely been a gap in terms of resources out there for people like us. You know, one of the things Chad says, he's always said, and he says at the end of every episode, is leaders don't develop in isolation. Leaders learn from leaders. And that's where the Chronicles part of the name came from, because we bring people on to tell their stories, like you do, and share their ideas and things that worked for them and things that maybe didn't, and, you know, how they evolved and developed.
I love this, Mary. What has been, looking back, the biggest challenge, setback, or roadblock that you've had to navigate in order to get where you are today? Or does it have to be the biggest, one of the biggest, let's say?
Well, I think when Nicole and I started Symbio, if everybody remembers what 2008 was like.
Oh, I remember.
Definitely. Yeah, it was the worst time to start a company for sure, because it was, we're in the middle of the housing crisis with the subprime loans, and you know the economy just went, you know, I guess as recruiters, we, you know, if you've been in it long enough, you're going to hit some downturns. But what also happened at the end of 2008 was, and we specialize in MSLs, right? There were a number of companies that laid off their entire teams. And these teams could be 40, 60 people big. And when a bunch of candidates get laid off and flood the market, as you might suspect, they don't really need us because all of these people are actively looking for jobs right now. So we did make the smart decision to start our business from home, which I never thought in a million years working from home would ever be a thing. Of course, now it is.
That's hilarious, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. So that was tough, you know, because, you know, also, you know, we respect our non-competes. And so even though we left the company we were with, we wanted to respect not going after clients we had. So we had to start everything from scratch. So it was a tough, probably first 9 months. I don't think we made a placement for 6 months.
Wow, that's rough.
Because we had to kind of start everything from scratch. That was tough. But I think that we were very proud of what we built and definitely proud of the culture we built, because that was one of the things we were dedicated to doing, is having a group that trusted each other, because recruiters, I guess, I mean, they get a bad reputation about being backstabbing, especially when you're so focused on the money.
It's competitive, yeah.
That you'll cut somebody's throat to make a placement. And it was very much like that in the first company we worked at. But we stayed the course.
Mary, your first year, you're in a downturn. There's not the hiring demand. And I mean, it wasn't just a downturn. It was like the Great Recession, right? And you're 6 months in, no placements yet. How did you get through that period and stay focused and committed to what you were trying to do?
I think we just had to keep encouraging each other. You know, we leaned on each other and supported each other, and we were sending leads to each other. And of course, we'd already been doing this. We'd been in this niche for a long time already. So fortunately, we had a lot of people we could still call and get ideas from. So as far as business development goes, at that point, we were doing a lot of who's got jobs posted. But also, I think that's where the relationship piece really became super evident, that was what was making the difference for us, because these companies knew, or these talent acquisition specialists or hiring managers knew us and knew they could count on us. And if we took a position, we were dedicated to filling it. And we were also okay with saying, I'm not going to be your best person to take that job, which is hard when you're struggling, I hate to say it, but we were, to tell a company, I can't take that biostatistician job. There's zero chance I'm going to fill that. But then they respect the fact that you tell them, I'm not your person for that.
Awesome. I love that. And the reason I asked this, Mary, is because what you just described, there's some folks who are going through a version of that now. To me, like, well, we're not in a recession, number one. And number two, it's more stagnant or low growth rather than contraction. But I have heard some recruiters tell me, especially maybe in technology, that they were a recruiter in the 2008-09 recession, and they're finding it harder now than they did then. So what advice do you have for someone who's maybe going through their the toughest moment in their career right now. And, you know, but they're working to turn this around.
Wow. That's a tough one, especially if you're talking about there's just no growth.
Yeah.
Well, I hate to say it, but, you know, if it's specifically technology, if that market is not bearing fruit for you, I think maybe if you've done enough homework to know that the forecast doesn't look like it's also not going to bear fruit in the next 9 months to a year, that you need to go find a different tree and figure out the trees that are going to be fruitful.
I mean, I think so. Technology is always going to come back, right? But it's a question of, can you last long enough? So I guess for you, like in MSL, would you ever switch to a different tree? Or
I would if for some reason the MSL function became non-existent. But I think because I do, you know, we do a really good job of understanding all of the roles within the big medical affairs microcosm and how they all interact. I think that I would try to pick another spoke in the wheel.
Yeah,
that makes sense for a transition.
Maybe not go to another tree, but can you go to a different branch of the same tree?
Yeah. I'm
fantastic.
Sorry, I can't really answer the question related to technology because I don't really understand what's going on in technology right now.
Yeah. Do you know what? It's not really a tech question. It's more about mindset and that's what I saw when you described you and Nicole going through that first tough year. I think it's more the mindset that you need to have in order to get through that and start, you know, seeing the success again.
Well, I'll tell you, at the end of the beginning of 2023, as I've been kind of watching some financial factors, I'm like, we're going to struggle in 2023, you guys. And we need to be ready for it. So actually we did this meeting at the end of 2022. And I said, this is how we are going to come out on the other side okay and better than our competitors, is because at the end of it all, it's going to be the relationships, the commitment, the integrity that you have, and that you're there for them when they don't have anything to give you. They'll be there for us when they do. So establishing and solidifying your relationships now is going to keep you from struggling like our competitors will. And I can tell you right now, I'm talking to some candidates that are like, oh, I talked to so-and-so at such and such company, and they said the market is just dry and slow. I'm like, that is not true. That is absolutely not. Our market, for us at least, came back in May. And I'm talking to people now, and we've done fine through this, which is really good, but not as good as we did in 2022 and 2021. But the reason that we are doing better than our competitors is because we solidified those relationships and we were there for them when they didn't have anything to give us.
Absolutely. Well, we've come full circle back to the relationship, you know, relationship-focused recruiting, relationship-based recruiting, Mary. And we are out of time. I loved this conversation. Thank you so much for doing this. And it was so much fun to catch up with you. Until we meet again, thanks, Mary. And have a good podcast recording and enjoy your networking event tonight.
All right. Thank you. Thank you very much.